The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So, Jackie, we're in the second podcast after the summer. Lots going on. And yeah, one of the major topics that continues to come up is sort of the stimulus packages for the green economy, the continued rise of electric vehicles and renewables and so on. But one term that keeps coming up is hydrogen. And that's what we're going to talk about again today.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about how important it is, how it's being talked about a lot. But Peter, this isn't new for you. You've had a history in the hydrogen economy for some time.
Yeah, I have. I mean, it seems that hydrogen makes a resurgence every 20 years or so. You know, there was sort of this hydrogen push. I can barely remember it. It was around the time of the oil price shocks and so on, when the price of oil was high and there was a push on to find alternatives to oil.
So that's like the late 70s.
Late 70s and 80s. And it came again around 2000, and that's when I was really involved in it. We were financing a lot of hydrogen companies, a lot of leading Canadian hydrogen companies. You know, we are real leaders in this country, certainly when it comes to things like fuel cell technologies and things like that, but it never really caught on. And that's the thing. We're going to talk about that today, why it is that hydrogen hasn't caught on, and maybe this is the dawn of a new era that's finally going to take hold. And we're very hydrogen rich in this province, so I think it's topical. We had a speaker from Proton Technologies, it was probably 18 months ago, but there's a new report out.
That's right, a new report. So we're very happy to introduce our special guest today from the Transition Accelerator. We've got Dan Wicklum here to talk about the new report, and also David Lazelle. Dan is the head of the Transition Accelerator, and David Lazelle is the director of research involved with the U of C, CSER, and the Transition Accelerator. So welcome to both of you.
That's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome. I've known both of you for a long time, so it's good to have you in the studios. We're going to talk about a number of things. I mean, your report that you just released, and we'll post that, right, Jackie?
Yeah, that's right. It's called Towards Net Zero Energy Systems in Canada, A Key Role for Hydrogen.
Yeah, yeah. So there's so much in this report, so much detail. You know, thanks for doing that. It's really important that we all get the numbers. I mean, I have to admit, it's a bit nerdy and geeky with all the numbers to plow through, but let's try and distill it down for our audience. We're going to talk about the end uses of hydrogen, how hydrogen is also produced, the economics, does it make financial sense? Is there money to be made in hydrogen these days or in the future? Importantly, the greenhouse gas benefits, the Canadian opportunity here, especially in Alberta.
Yeah, and specifically, we want to learn a bit more about the next report. Our understanding is this is the first of two reports. This report is informing a report about Alberta's industrial heartland, and is there an opportunity to have a hydrogen economy right here in Alberta? And that's expected later this autumn. So before we start, tell us about the Transition Accelerator, and why is this organization interested in hydrogen?
Well, the Transition Accelerator is a new organization. We launched it about a year ago. It's a charity. It's pan-Canadian. We operate right across the country. And our mandate is to accelerate system change, but to do it using a new methodology. And our methodology essentially is to very much understand at a deep level disruptions or transformations that are happening in the economy as we speak, meaning the world will be a different place whether we do nothing or not. So what we do is we scan the Canadian economy for disruptions. So think business model, social disruptions, technological disruptions. And using our new methodology, we figure out where we can insert ourselves in a conversation, not to slow down a disruption, but to speed it up, to accelerate it, to use it, or to what we call direct it down specific stepwise pathways to do two things, solve business and social challenges, but we also want to build deep emissions reductions into the solutions. But I think the thing that we do differently is we actually take action. So we do analysis that's required. We build transition pathways, but we then want to launch coalitions to take very tangible steps down these pathways to attain these positive futures.
So system change, I mean, that's sort of a very broad term. You're talking about the economy. We see disruptions everywhere, whether it's in retail or entertainment and so on. You're specifically focused on system change in energy.
System change in any part of the economy, but ones that have an implication for emissions reductions. But again, we don't lead with that. We lead with using these system change to solve business challenges. And that's what's led us directly to hydrogen. Mm-hmm. So Canada has this remarkable, unique competitive advantage with hydrogen, being able to produce it at a fraction of the cost of almost anywhere else in the world. So that's what's led us to focus on acceleration of the deployment of a hydrogen economy.
Okay, well, let's, for our audience, sort of clarify hydrogen. Hydrogen is an energy carrier, a fuel. We'll get to how it's produced, why it's great here, but let's just talk about the end uses, because I think there's a lot of confusion about where you would use hydrogen in a world that is dominated by hydrocarbons, which has hydrogen in it. That's the hydro. So let's talk about the various uses. And why don't we start with industrial use?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that hydrogen is getting a lot of attention these days, but there's already a very well-developed hydrogen economy in the world, and frankly, in Canada. Alberta is mm-hmm. one of the biggest producers and users of industrial hydrogen. We use it to make fertilizer. We use it to help upgrade our fossil fuels. But at this point, there's not widespread use of hydrogen as a fuel in the world. As we look into the future, 72 countries now have a net zero emission ambition. And in order to attain that net zero, you know, we're really going to have to change our energy mix, which mm-hmm. means massive electrification. But the reality is that not everything can be electrified. To move heavy things around the landscape, hydrogen seems to be emerging as the fuel of choice. You can burn hydrogen in a combustion engine or in a hydrogen fuel cell, and water is the only thing out the tailpipe. So are these unique uses for hydrogen, transportation, some heating applications, additional industrial uses that you can't really get to a net zero energy system any other way.
Well, we'll talk about transportation and come back to the uses in a minute, but I think there's certainly confusion, I think, in the public about all the different colors of hydrogen.
That's right. We hear about gray hydrogen, blue hydrogen, and green hydrogen. What are each of those?
I've even heard brown.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, people tend to use colors to describe different types of hydrogen that are made from different production processes. So very simply, you can make hydrogen from splitting the water molecule into its constituent hydrogen and oxygen using electricity. People call that green hydrogen. You can take a fossil fuel. Almost always in the world, it's natural gas, but you can also take other fossil fuels, think coal or oil or even bitumen potentially, and upgrade it in some type of reforming process. And if the resulting carbon dioxide from that upgrading is liberated into the atmosphere, that's called gray hydrogen. But if you were to capture that carbon dioxide and then sequester it or use it in some other way, that's called blue hydrogen. So the colors are really around describing the production process to make hydrogen and what to do with the carbon dioxide. One of the challenges with that is people also tend to equate a color of hydrogen with their carbon intensity. And what the Accelerator report points out is that's not a very good assumption. So colors really should be used to describe production rather than carbon intensity.
Right. Well, you just used the example of green hydrogen and it's using electricity, but it really depends on what the source of electricity is, if that ultimately is greenhouse gas emissions free or not.
That's exactly it. And I think the other interesting point that the report pointed out is that some types of blue hydrogen made from upgrading a natural gas can be less GHG or carbon intensive than some types of green hydrogen. So that just points to the pitfalls of using colors to equate to carbon rather than simply production technology.
Okay, so your report, Peter talked about this at the beginning, that 20 years ago there was a lot of hype around hydrogen and maybe 20 years before that. Your report talks about the vicious cycle that prevents the emergence of hydrogen. What do you mean by that?
We'll set up the answer just with a data point. So here in Alberta, we can make hydrogen for about a third to a half the cost of diesel fuel on a per gigajoule basis. So it's inherently cheaper energy. And that's with the cost of carbon capture and storage all built in. But we don't have a well-developed hydrogen as fuel economy because there's no scale of demand. And there's no scale of demand because there's no scale of supply. So they're able to realize that cost benefit of hydrogen, it has to be at a large scale. And because we don't have that large scale, we don't have demand or supply.
Nor do we have the infrastructure to sort of deliver it in between. I mean, from over longer distance. I mean, hydrogen production and consumption in most countries is typically fairly localized, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, the world is getting excited about hydrogen because its potential to help decarbonize society and yet not leave assets stranded mm-hmm. and so on. Peter, I think what we would say is that concept of no infrastructure is inherent in our concept of there's no supply, meaning, you know, production and distribution capacity.
Yeah, it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, mm-hmm. right? Like it works really well, but you don't have the infrastructure so that everyone would go convert their vehicles because they will drive to Calgary and suddenly there's no hydrogen. Maybe it's in Edmonton. And so until you get that infrastructure, it's a barrier, even if the economics work.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about, for example, solar and wind on the front end as power generation, it was just plug and play. In fact, unplug the coal plant, plug in the solar and wind farms, and the grid was there. And on the consuming end, people just plug their electric vehicles in, where you put up charging stations by electric power lines. And it sort of worked. But let's get to the transportation side of hydrogen. That's one of the issues, is that the in-between is not really fully developed yet.
No, I think that's exactly it. I mean, that is inherently the challenge with hydrogen, is that if we were to have a system at scale, meaning use or demand and supply, it would be economic or even cheaper for transportation. I mean, the fuel would be cheaper. And if we could somehow get to scale, not only would we be able to reap this fantastic environmental benefits, but it would actually, the system would be inherently cheaper.
Now, I'm really excited, though. I think one way we can create an instant market for hydrogen is to substitute some of the use of natural gas in our existing natural gas system. So today, throughout the world, but in Alberta too, we have retail distribution of natural gas to our homes and buildings. And you could substitute a part of that, a fraction of that, with hydrogen. And that's actually a huge market. And there is a recently announced pilot with ATCO who's going to be blending a little bit of hydrogen into the retail network in Fort Saskatchewan. So to me, this really solves the problem that there just wasn't a market and no infrastructure, but we can hijack the infrastructure that we already have to start to use some hydrogen for natural gas.
I think that's very promising. So ATCO is an early mover here in Alberta. Enbridge is doing the same thing in Ontario. I think it's of note to point to places like Hong Kong and Hawaii, where they have over 50% of hydrogen added into their system. So these are not sort of technical issues. This is going to be done technically. It's really, what are the steps we need to take in order to realize this this benefit? Usually without any type of change of kit, meaning valves on pipelines or burners inside of people's houses or in their stove in their kitchen, usually the figure about 20% by volume hydrogen addition can be accommodated without any change in kit. After that, there needs to be some retrofit or upgrade.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have like a 5 BCF per day market in Alberta. So 20% of that is a pretty significant market for a new business. I wanted to talk about Peter's latest vignette, right? About hijacking infrastructure. We'll maybe put a link to that.
Yeah, I mean, adoption is really catalyzed much easier if you can, as I called it in my latest Energy File vignette, hijack an existing infrastructure. You know, Thomas Edison, way back when the electric light bulb came out, basically put wires through pipes of existing coal gas lighting pipes and hijacked the infrastructure so they didn't have to rip the walls down and put up wiring and then replaster the walls. They just use, you know, so to me, there's a lot of parallels here using the existing natural gas system to feed hydrogen through it. But again, for the benefit of our audience, like, what does this do? Like, you're saying, Dan, that basically they don't have to buy a new furnace. They don't have to buy a new gas stove. They don't even know hydrogen is coming through the pipe. But it's a cleaner fuel in a sense that there's lower emissions at the end of the day.
Yep, that's exactly it. You know, you can substitute about 20% without anyone really having to do anything or knowing about it. After that, there does need to be changes to the system.
So June 2019 International Energy Agency report talked about some of these barriers to adoption. And they mentioned on several pages, the regulatory and safety policies, right? Do we have sort of a regulatory and safety policies established for things like putting more hydrogen through natural gas? You know, I mean, these sorts of things are, you know, very strict in terms of our regulatory policies of what you can put through pipes and, you know, the Canadian Energy Regulator. I mean, I don't know who governs all this stuff.
When I get that question, I think back in this notion that we already have quite a well-developed hydrogen economy in the country. Again, it's industrial for an industrial feedstock, but we know how to make hydrogen. We know how to distribute it safely. We know how to use it safely. As we go towards new uses, whether it's decarbonizing space heat or using transportation, this will require new standards and new regs. Almost everything that we need for a self-sustaining hydrogen economy in Canada is being done somewhere else in the world.
Yeah.
At least parts of it, not necessarily altogether. So these things are being thought about in real time. And I think the other way to think about it is like every time we've gone through an energy transition for the last hundreds of years, there's always been angst around regs and safety, but we've always been able to figure it out. We can do this.
Yeah. You know, what gets me really interested and excited about what you're doing is I think you're taking a holistic approach, because if we think, certainly if I think back to 20 years ago, it was all very piecemeal. You know, it wasn't a holistic approach where, okay, you had to have emphasis on all of the different potential barriers to the transition, you know, the regulatory, the infrastructure, the finance, the economics, the technology, right? And it seems to me that you're trying to put everything together holistically as a paper or a series of papers to guide policymakers and industry?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, what the accelerator is all about is not just analysis, but taking action and launching coalitions to take advantage of this opportunity. So that's exactly what we're doing in our project in the Heartland, for example.
Economics matter, and we'll definitely bring David into the conversation here. I spent a lot of time looking at the economics, and I encourage our listeners to check out the report because it's the most holistic look I've seen in terms of the economics, especially associated with Western Canada. Now, your report made the case that if you can assume policy we have today and some future policy, you could make the case that the economics work. So, for example, for production of wholesale transportation fuels, you showed that blue hydrogen may be about half the cost of diesel. You mentioned that already. But then when you put the distribution on, it gets a little more challenging. As Peter said, that there's a lot of cost associated with that. And you talked about the fact that if we had the clean fuel standard, which we have talked a little bit about on the podcast. In fact, the Saskatchewan Energy Minister brought it up a few weeks ago. But if you had that policy, you thought you could probably make it work. Also, you talked about the use of replacing natural gas for heating, and we talked about the advantage we have in that respect because we have the infrastructure, at least for about 20% of the market. But the economics of this were more challenging. The price of natural gas was about $2 per gigajoule, where the production of blue or green hydrogen was more than 10 times greater. And you talked about the fact that, well, again, that clean fuel standard is pretty important in terms of maybe making this work. So, David, maybe you could talk a little bit about these economics and the policies needed to get this over the finish line and get people investing in it.
Yes, and as you point out, I think the business case and the economic case for using hydrogen as a transportation fuel, especially, you know, targeting the diesel market and the heavy freight market, is that economics is much closer. In fact, our analysis is that you may not even need the clean fuel standard in order to make it cost competitive with diesel, because we can produce hydrogen very inexpensively if we can create large fueling stations that have a large throughput of hydrogen. And those can be positioned strategically in locations where perhaps with pipeline distribution, where we're also using the same pipelines to feed hydrogen into natural gas systems. Then what you start to get is an economics of both scale and strategic placement that suggests that we can actually achieve a transportation fuel, for example, that is cost competitive and within the very near future.
So if we can find those niche markets and get them large enough, it actually could work today, you think, even with the infrastructure costs?
I think it could work today. The clean fuel standard, though, I think is really important in that it actually could help to make it even more attractive. Because we have another problem within this part of the vicious cycle, is that the cost of the vehicle, a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, for example, is more expensive than the cost of the incumbent diesel vehicle. And so one also has to think about the whole value chain. And by decreasing the cost of the transportation fuel to be lower than diesel as a hydrogen fuel, it's possible to help with the total cost of ownership for the vehicle and justify more investment in the actual vehicle that is going to consume the hydrogen.
Well, and the clean fuel standard burdens the hydrocarbon fuel, so therefore it kind of levelized the economics. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. And that's the exciting opportunity on the diesel market. On the natural gas market, the clean fuel standard is also very important there, because the clean fuel standard, or new clean fuel standard for gaseous fuels, is supposed to be coming out in the next couple of years. It already exists in British Columbia, and we can learn a lot from what's happening in BC, as there's a requirement to reduce the carbon intensity of natural gas. And hydrogen is, when you actually look at the alternatives of what's possible to reduce the life cycle carbon intensity of natural gas, hydrogen is an alternative that will be the most cost-effective way of meeting the clean fuel standards for natural gas fuels. The alternative is renewable natural gas. And it's probably 2 to 3 times more expensive than hydrogen.
So basically, there's a requirement to reduce the intensity of the fuel, the natural gas fuel, maybe by around 10% or 12%, I think the number is.
Yep.
And so then you've got to replace some natural gas, and hydrogen seems obvious, even though the price is higher. So, for example, it's $2 per gigajoule right now, for a little bit higher, maybe Canadian, for natural gas. And the alternative hydrogen can be produced between $7 to $20. So that's not going to work economically. But this policy is going to say, regardless of price, you have to meet a certain carbon intensity. Therefore, you need to use this much hydrogen, even though it is more money than the natural gas. That's going to incent more use of hydrogen in our natural gas stream.
Yes.
And I think for me, the key is at this point, hydrogen is the most economically effective option to attain that outcome.
And then also getting right down to the sort of the granular level of human behavior and decision-making at a corporate level. Let's just take the example of the diesel trucks. Okay, so I'm a truck fleet operator. I've got a fleet of, I don't know, couple hundred trucks. And all this stuff is coming at me. And I'm thinking, okay, I have to swap out my trucks. I have to put in a hydrogen fueling station in my warehouse or warehouses across the country. Somebody has to build the pipeline infrastructure. We got to figure out how to do the accounting for the different colors of hydrogen, which that infrastructure isn't even in place. We've got to figure out where the hydrogen on the supply side is going to come from. And if it's blue hydrogen, it's got to come from carbon capture, which has also got its challenges in terms of being financed. So like I'm sort of cascading this thing down to reality because I like the theory, but the reality is a lot more complicated than trying to get this thing going.
You're absolutely right. This is one of the reasons that we've been really focusing on trying to do it in specific regions in nodes, because then you can get the scale and you can try to work out a lot of the complexity and the detail in a particular region where you know you have a supply of hydrogen, you can know the quality or the carbon intensity of that hydrogen, and you can start to identify where the barriers might exist in terms of connecting that supply to demand, whether it's demand in transportation, heavy transportation, or demand in natural gas, or maybe a demand in the steel industry, for example.
I guess what I'm really getting at is, I mean, this is one big complicated thing that needs to be done. You have to have everybody singing from the same proverbial songbook. We understand that potentially there's going to be some government policy coming down the pipe, pardon the pun. And my question is this government policy going to be at all coordinated holistically so that the pieces can be all put together? Because otherwise, I think we're going to revert back to what I saw 20 years ago, which is just little rifle shots here and there, and nothing really catalyzed because there was no holistic vision of how you get from the source to the consuming end in any meaningful way. And on top of that, really, who's going to finance it anyway?
So I think you're absolutely right. It's a very complex issue. So the scale of implementation is very important. So at the accelerator, what we've done is we've defined the sub-regional scale, so think municipality or transportation corridor, as the critical scale at which we have to focus in order to be able to break the vicious cycle, create demand and supply concurrently and in concert. So we have a white paper that describes the concept of a hydrogen node, mm-hmm. where we would roll out hydrogen in Canada, very specifically in places where we've identified to have the best place, the best places in the country to attain economic viability the quickest, and that this would be done very deliberately to be able to link these places quickly into a national economy. That's exactly what the Transition Accelerator does.
The other good news is that countries around the world are recognizing that this is a very complex problem. We are creating a new value chain, a whole new energy system in order to meet net zero by 2050. And there are more than 25 or 30 countries in the world that are coming out with hydrogen strategies. And we can learn a lot by reading their strategies and seeing how we can apply them to Canadian conditions.
Okay, well, with that, let's talk about the opportunity for Canada. Your report had some information that was quite interesting in terms of what the size of this market could be for us. And one thing that you highlighted was a 2018 Japanese study that showed Canada had some of the lowest costs for producing both blue and green hydrogen in the world. Why is Canada well-positioned relative to others?
Well, on the green hydrogen is that many of the provinces in Canada have a very low-carbon electrical grid. And in fact, a number of the provinces like Quebec and even Ontario with nuclear power, Quebec with large hydro, have excess electricity. They produce more electricity than they need all the time. And they are then able to convert that electricity into hydrogen and green hydrogen. There's other provinces like on the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, Alberta in particular, northern British Columbia and southern Saskatchewan, which have access to very low-cost natural gas. And they're also sitting on a basin where there's a lot of holy rocks. They've got a lot of space to hold carbon and sequester carbon permanently in the subsurface. And that combination means that we can produce blue hydrogen at almost the cheapest prices in the world, the lowest cost prices in the world.
I keep hearing from people in this country that we're behind in the hydrogen game, even though we're one of the largest producers for industrial purposes. So can you reconcile why we're behind if we are behind?
So I think it depends on how you want to define the definition of behind. So there's no question that other countries have been thinking about a broader use of hydrogen longer. They're making investments before we are. They're deploying hydrogen production and hydrogen as a fuel use at larger scales than we are. But I think it's really important to understand that, you know, we feel the accelerator, we're really in the early months of a fundamental retooling of the global energy system that will involve a much larger proportion of hydrogen. And that's going to take decades. So, you know, we may be a bit slow out of the gate, but we have this advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't dither if we want to take advantage of this advantage and to capitalize on our ability to essentially make the cheapest hydrogen in the world. We do need to act quickly. So it's not, to me, whether or not we're out of the gate the quickest. It's whether or not we are willing to put in the effort quickly to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if we ultimately have these lower production costs, we should have a great advantage. Now, your report found that this industry could grow to over $100 billion a year industry for hydrogen, which is a pretty huge number. That's just on the revenue side. And it had the ability to replace about 27% of all Canada's energy demand with a lot of the uses that we've talked about. You also talked about the fact that we could export our hydrogen to the U.S. For example, why not convert our existing natural gas pipelines to California, who really wants to move into net zero to hydrogen and be an advantage supplier to them? And you also talked about the fact that we could export some hydrogen overseas, which got me kind of interested. I never really thought about that. You talked about places like Japan, South Korea, and Germany as potential markets. How would we transport hydrogen overseas?
A lot of interest in movement of hydrogen on ships. And it's most of the discussion and the reports coming out of Japan, South Korea, Germany, look at hydrogen being imported to those countries as liquid hydrogen. It's a cryogenic liquid. It's not minus 253 degrees Celsius, so it's only 20 degrees Celsius above absolute zero. In many ways, it's very similar to liquid natural gas. When you pull the heat out of natural gas and you get it to about minus 160 degrees Celsius, you get LNG, liquid natural gas, and it could be moved in large insulated container ships to locations around the world. The same kind of technology that's used to make liquid natural gas can be used to make liquid hydrogen. You just have to take the temperature a lot lower. The second opportunity in moving a large amount of hydrogen to other places is convert it to ammonia and move hydrogen as a liquid ammonia, essentially, and then convert it back into hydrogen at the distant location. Or you can actually, there are technologies for using ammonia to create electricity, ammonia fuel cells, or you can even burn ammonia in combustion engines. Mm-hmm. Then there are a few other suggestions, which are organic hydrogen carriers. Our techno-economic analysis to date suggests that ammonia and liquid hydrogen are the ones that are the most promising for large-scale export.
So, I mean, again, this is all aspirational, and I know that it's all where the world is probably headed, but I want to talk about time frame because, you know, just building an LNG terminal with the pipeline took forever. And I know you're going to say, well, that involved all sorts of environmental issues and land claim issues and so on and so forth. And the IEA report that we don't really have a robust regulatory framework for safety of moving hydrogen. This is going to take a long time. Like, what is the time frame of your report?
we're looking over the next 30 years that would actually take us to a significant, very significant hydrogen economy in Canada. But there are many things that can be done within the next 2 to 5 years and certainly 10 years. So I think we can get started on deploying a hydrogen economy regionally in our nodes, but we can also look in terms of export markets of going to the companies that are looking at exporting liquid natural gas. Liquid hydrogen is essentially the same technology. It can piggyback on the same infrastructure that you talked about before, Peter. And we should be able to actually identify and open up markets for liquid hydrogen overseas markets, often with the same companies that are interested in buying the LNG today. And in effect, piggybacking on that technology and opening up more lucrative markets for liquid hydrogen in other places in the world.
And I would say, I mean, there's no question that it's a very complex issue in terms of how and when to export hydrogen. But I think we have to take a look at it in the global context. And it's happening as we speak. So Australia is the first country that is producing hydrogen and shipping on a liquid hydrogen carrier to Japan. Mm-hmm. Last week, Australia signed an agreement, a memorandum of understanding with Germany. In some regards, our report make predictions in terms of what market size could be and therefore had to make assumptions. But this is not theoretical in the sense that countries have been very explicit, Germany, Japan, South Korea, and even California, saying we will be importing hydrogen. So the race is on. So we have, there's no question it's complex and we need to sort it out. But as Canadian governments and Canadian industry sort through an approach, we have to understand that we're in a race and we cannot dither.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, look, the opportunity's there. I believe it. I'm just a little jaded by our inability in this country to be able to think holistically and in a coordinated manner, candidly, to get these things up, because there's so much to do to get all this thing up and running and humming. And I like your approach of start small and local and then quickly grow it and then think about the bigger picture as we go into the decades beyond.
And it is really exciting that there's an export market. You know, a lot of the times when we look at clean energy, it's limited in terms of what it can do for our economy because we only have a fairly small amount of domestic use of energy. Like most of our energy economy mm-hmm. is exports. So it's exciting that there's already an export market starting. I hope it'll be faster for us to build a terminal for hydrogen than it has been for LNG. But with that, let's wrap up and talk about these micro areas that you want to get started. And the Alberta Industrial Heartland Task Force report is coming. Maybe give us an update on the timing. We're very interested to know what that has to say. But why do you think that Alberta's Industrial Heartland is the place where we should have the hydrogen economy start in Canada?
Well, a few months ago, what we did is we took the accelerator methodology and we created some criteria and applied the methodology using the criteria basically to everywhere in Canada to understand if you were going to start a hydrogen economy in Canada, where would be the best place? So, for example, where's the cheapest hydrogen? Where is there technical capability to make and distribute hydrogen right now? Where's there motivated leadership? In the Alberta Industrial Heartland, Edmonton and surrounding regions popped up as the number one location. It's certainly not the only location, but it's the number one. So what we did is about 3 months ago, we launched a task force, which is led by the 5 elected officials of the Heartland jurisdiction, so counties and 2 cities. And we put in place 14 advisors. So think very senior executives from relevant provincial departments in Alberta, federal departments, CEOs or VPs of industry associations. And we asked ourselves just a very simple question. And it's designed to get at Peter's angst, which is, sure, in theory, how do you do it? How do you actually do it? What are the very specific steps that you can take quickly to make progress? So we said that we would put into the public domain in a very short length of time, in a matter of weeks, a report that created the business case. So you see that report that was released last week. And the next report coming that will be released in the weeks coming will do exactly that. It'll lay out the steps that we need to take in order to track to a real economically viable hydrogen economy at the region of the Heartland.
So it'll have specific recommendations of policy and
so
steps?
So we think less in terms of recommendations and more in terms of actionable steps. And that's the one thing that we really, really want to focus on is, you know, analysis are easy in one regard. Strategies and plans are easy to create in regard, but how do you actually action them? How do you implement them? How do you deploy them? So we defined deployable actionable steps. And then critically, what we want to do is assemble coalitions of companies, governments, stakeholders, indigenous stakeholders, and start taking these steps. So that's the concept of creating a transition pathway and then taking steps down the pathway. And we think it's we can do that in the heartland, but there's probably many places across the country. Think Vancouver, Winnipeg, several places in the Maritimes. Think Charlottetown, St. John's, of course, many cities in Ontario and Quebec where this could happen, where we could take this methodology that we've developed and almost in a cookie cutter way, very quickly deploy it across the country. But extremely importantly, do it on a common framework with independent analysis and with a foresight to understanding that the eventual goal is to link these nodes together in terms of material flow. So that's why the concept of a transportation corridor linking these nodes is important for movement of trucks, for example, or movement of hydrogen through pipelines. So we're adamant that it's great to have a strategy or a plan. What we need is a way to implement and make it real. And that's what we're focusing on.
So when you say actionable items as we wrap up here and your report and reports to come, who's your target audience? Actionable items for who? Like, who are you pitching all this to?
I think for us, what we try to do is work with the organizations that will actually be taking the steps. So these are governments. This is industry writ large, but in industry associations in some cases.
I think it's important to recognize that one of the things that we're trying to do with this first report is not only engage governments, engage industry, but also engage investors and the banks and try to make a business case that we can move to a low-carbon economy in the next 30 years and do it in an economically viable way that will create jobs, that creates return on investment. And that's what this first report is aimed at.
You know, Dave, that's a great point. So, you know, we did hold a briefing for about 60 representatives broadly from the financial community a couple of weeks ago to give folks a sneak peek at the report. I think everything ranging from the infrastructure bank to mainstream banks like Scotiabank or CIBC, right down to local funders like Emissions Reductions Alberta. And we'll be holding more of those briefings and engagement sessions as we go. And I encourage people to follow us on either Twitter or LinkedIn to get any of our reports and thinking in real time.
Okay, well, with that, we'll wrap up. I encourage our listeners to check out the Transition Accelerator's report around hydrogen. We'll put a link to it. I, for one, am super excited about the potential. It's great that we have this report because it actually creates a common understanding amongst all these different groups. It was really very difficult to understand the economics. And so you guys have done some great work to create that baseline and context for everyone. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the upcoming report. We'll be talking about it on our podcast as well. So thank you very much for joining our podcast, both Dan and David.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks so much for the invitation. It's been great.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell someone else about it and like us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.